Hello, time travelers. Welcome back to Biblical Time Machine. I am one of your hosts, Dave Roos. I am here with Helen Bond, professor of Christian origins at the University of Edinburgh. So a couple years ago when my family visited Israel, we definitely went to Capernaum. I'm trying to remember. It was like we saw so many Galilean towns in a row. I'm trying to remember which one this was. Helen, have you been to Capernaum?
Yeah, I have. I mean, the thing I remember most about it was looking through this sort of glass thing at the synagogue underneath, you know, that's supposed to be the home of Peter's mother-in-law and sort of, you know, a synagogue there that's supposed to go back really very, very old. You know, is it the one that Jesus went to and all of that stuff? So that's the thing that most stays in my head.
Yeah, is that what we were looking at? I mean, I remember there was like a glass floor, a very cool kind of modern chapel. I thought that was supposed to be Peter's house. That wasn't Peter's house. Peter's house.
Yeah, well, I think there's sort of two things. Like, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. Definitely Peter's house too, but also synagogue, I think. I think there's maybe, I don't know if they're the same place or they're next to each other or, what we need
We can Google this.
We need an expert on Capernaum.
Oh, that's funny. We just talked to one. So, well, Capernaum, if you remember from reading the New Testament, it is like home base for Jesus and the disciples in several of the stories. Seems to be that maybe their home base. Yeah, they're the center of operations in the Galilee. So clearly very important. And as we mentioned here, maybe was one of the places where the Gospels were written. You think maybe Mark, is a chance that was written in Capernaum?
No.
I thought that came up.
Yeah, it did. It did come up. Yeah. I mean, no, it's a really interesting suggestion. And I mean, who knows? We don't know where the Gospels were written, but I tend to think they were urban and not that close to sort of the Jewish homeland. But it's an intriguing suggestion that it did come from Capernaum or one of these places like that. And certainly there's people who think it's from Galilee generally. So, you know, who knows?
Who knows? Well, we have an excellent guest with an excellent name. We spoke with Wally Sirofesi. He is an assistant professor in New Testament studies at the Swedish Collegium for Advanced Study and the Center for Theology and Religious Studies at Lund University, all those things in Sweden. Wally is a terrific guy. He's done archaeological excavations nearby in the also really cool site at Magdala, and he's thought deeply about the archaeology of Capernaum and what it can tell us about the relation between Jews and Christians and Jewish Christian and Christian Jews and at this fascinating period of history when there was a lot of flux between these groups, when they weren't quite as separate and identified as we think about them. So that's what we're going to talk about today with Wally. But before we get to that, Helen, I've got some news for you. I did not share this with you before coming on the air, but I'm very excited to announce that the Biblical Time Machine store is open for business.
The store? Isn't that exciting? What are you talking about? You started having a shop?
She's looking at... She literally has no idea what I'm talking about. So,
like so often, Dave. Like so often.
Please, explain yourself. So now, if you go to biblicaltimemachine.com, which has existed, there is a new tab that says Store. Ooh. And there you can buy a total of two different things. One of them, I'm going to get for myself because it's fun, is a mug. A mug that has the Biblical Time Machine logo on it. And you could have your tea or coffee in it. And I think our fans are just going to scoop those up. But I think even more exciting is this, Helen does know about. We have been working behind the scenes on a audio study guide. So this is... This is coming out, Helen. So this is a 4-part audio study guide. Basically, think of it as, you know, a personal podcast. And it's about the Gospel of Mark as an ancient biography. So Helen wrote a whole book about the Gospel of Mark as an ancient biography. And we have kind of distilled that research into 4 fascinating episodes that you can listen to. And we have... questions, kind of study and discussion questions that you can ask yourself, or you can ask a group of people if you want to get together, a little Bible study group. we think is really cool. It is available now on the Biblical Time Machine store at biblicaltimemachine.com. Go check it out. All right, Helen, I know you've been excited to announce the latest winners of the SBL Study Bible Giveaway. Who are our winners?
Yeah, I am really excited to tell you this week the two winners are Jane Purr and Bert Wood. Hooray! Well done, Jane and Bert. You're going to get your study Bibles soon.
I think next week, because we're running out of time, next week we will announce the winner of the other giveaway that we have, which is for a free pass to the four-day SBL Global Virtual Meeting. So come on, folks, get your name in the running. Subscribe to the Time Travelers Club, our Patreon. You will support the show, and we will give back to you in the form of these fun giveaways. So if you want a chance to attend this virtual conference, which is very cool, very high-profile stuff, then get yourself in the running and join the Time Travelers Club. As always, the link is in the show description below. But for now, let's get to our conversation with Wally Serafisi about the intriguing archaeology of ancient Capernaum. Wally Serafisi, welcome to Biblical Time Machine.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
All right. Well, for our listeners who have never been to Capernaum, who might have only read about it in the Bible, kind of tell us about where it's located, you know, what it might have looked like in the time of Jesus. Give us a little primer on Capernaum.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have any PowerPoint slides to show you. That probably would have been, the best way to do it. But if you can imagine the Sea of Galilee or the Kinneret Lake, Capernaum is just on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. So, I mean, it literally buds up to the lake. So, very much a lakeside village, both in the time of Jesus and much later as well. So. But yeah, Capernaum, I mean, there's a whole lot of different takes on what Capernaum was like in the time of Jesus. Anywhere between, older assumptions about it being actually quite large, with lots and lots of people, upwards to 10 or 15,000 people. Those estimates have been reduced quite a bit down, rightly so, in my opinion, to where the population was probably at its peak. Capernaum was probably about 1,500 people or so, probably less.
Oh, wow.
During the time of Jesus. But still, for its size and, for what we know about its broader context in the Galilee, in my opinion, a pretty connected village. So that's the term that I tend to talk about, or the term that I tend to use to talk about Capernaum. Not necessarily, an urban hubbub, with lots of, wealth and riches and all these kinds of things, but also not necessarily the old kind of, country hinterland, that we used to think about in terms of these small Galilean villages. Very much a connected village, certainly with, at least in my opinion, certainly with other villages around the shore. So you have Magdala, that's about less than 10 kilometers away. And then, of course, the major polis, the major city in that area being Tiberias in the time of Jesus. So, so from my perspective, there's lots of reason to see Capernaum as connected to those other places and part of the general life, which seems to have been thriving in the time of Jesus.
And what about the synagogue that you can see the remains of there, with this sort of large and impressive building? Was that there in the first century, or is that a later thing?
Yeah, so it's much later. So back in the late 19th century, that might have been the thought, right? That we had sort of one report from a 19th century archaeologist, saying that certainly this, this great white limestone synagogue that we see, must have been the synagogue that the centurion built and is the one of the holiest places in the world. But now, I mean, after after 100 years or so of excavations, now we're pretty confident that certainly the white limestone building is much later. Now I think most scholars are putting it around the late 5th and even early 6th century. But then the question, of course, is what's underneath, right? Mm-hmm. What's underneath that building? Mm. And that's where a lot of New Testament scholars get engaged with some of the archaeological discussions about, was there was there a building from the time of Jesus, like the gospel seemed to say?
Because have they not found like a more humble synagogue elsewhere in Capernaum that might have been that in that time period?
Yeah, well, I mean, really all that they have found, and they being the Franciscan archaeologist who excavated back in the late 60s and early 70s, really all they found was a large cobblestone pavement that dated to the first century or so. So like kind of like what they call the early Roman period, right? So the question is, what was this the pavement of, right? And so a lot of interpretation has to go into it, and you have to sort of, you know, work on the basis of context and those kinds of things. My own opinion is that this probably was the floor. This is probably a floor of a first century public building, which... first century public building in a Jewish village. That's what we kind of tend to think about a synagogue, right? Mm. Of course, it's a little bit more complicated than that. But I tend to think that it's that floor, that first century pavement was probably, if you want to use the term, the more humble building, that was probably a synagogue from the time of Jesus.
Mm. Still exciting. So if Capernaum then for centuries, I mean, well, for a long time, when Jesus is there, I mean, it's a Jewish village, and for centuries or a long time afterwards, it's also a Jewish village. When do we get the first sort of signs of Christian groups, Christ worshippers, yeah, Christ believers in this early period?
Yeah, whatever term you want to use.
I know,
yeah.
It's contested, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of it depends on how you identify or how you define Christian, quote unquote.
Yeah,
right?
I
mean, my own opinion is that there probably is some archaeological evidence going back to even like the late first, early second century in what's called Room 1. So this is the side of the village where you now sits on top of this area, this big octagonal church from around the 5th or 6th century, which clearly became a place for Christian gathering and Christian memory of Jesus and the Apostle Peter. But if you go down the layers, and this is, of course, what the Franciscans did, there does seem to be some evidence that as early as the late 1st century or early 2nd century, the room was starting to be used for some unique things, right? I mean, it starts to, you get the sense that the room is not just a room. I mean, there's not really any indication, there's no writing, there's no, writing saying, we who worship Jesus, live here or come here every Sunday or something like that, right? Of course, we'd love that as historians. We'd love that kind of direct, evidence, but nothing like that. But if we think about probability, if we think about, the idea that we as historians, what we do is we hardly ever deal with direct evidence, right? We're always inferring from the evidence that we have. And so if we think about history that way, then probably, late first century, early second century, we have some sort of evidence for Christ devotion. My own opinion is that these are still Jews, because Capernaum is still a Jewish town. Mm-hmm. The larger material setting or the setting of the house is still a Jewish home. So even though we have some sort of activity that seems to be oriented around Christ devotion, this is still a Jewish expression, a Jewish mode of that. And it's not until probably the 4th and then maybe stronger in the 5th and 6th centuries where you have sort of non-Jewish Christianity really taking shape and beginning to influence the village.
I'm just curious, so what is it about that room, or what is this evidence that makes you think there was some Jesus stuff going on in here?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a good question. So, I mean, and this is like the crux interpretum, right? This is the fundamental kind of issue about what was this room actually used for at this point in time, late first, early second century. So what seems to happen is that this particular room, a couple things happen, gets plastered up the wazoo, okay? In other words, it just gets it receives layers and layers of white plaster on the floor, the walls, and then it's kept, according to the excavators, they describe it as it was kept scrupulously clean, right? So there's no evidence of any kind of domestic vessels there, no kind of everyday practice. It seems to be a room set apart, okay, from the rest. And no other room from ancient Capernaum was treated that way. We've got no other evidence from the entire village. So But that's all we have, right? And so admittedly, like that's not a whole lot to go on. No. And so from my perspective, yeah, not at all. And this is why, of course, some, you know, really important scholars like Joan Taylor has really called, you know, some of this, these kinds of interpretations into question, and rightly so. But, you know, when we start to think also diachronically as well, so, you know, late 4th century, this room then gets, you know, quite heavily renovated. And you can tell that the space is starting to take shape in a way that revolves around assembly, some sort of assembly practice. And then if we coordinate it with some other literary testimony, especially the testimony of Egeria, who was a 4th century pilgrim who traveled around the quote-unquote Holy Land around this time, she gives witness to actually coming to the house of Peter, whether it was actually the house of Peter, like the question of authenticity doesn't really, really get me very much. But she seems to see something and to give witness to the fact that people are starting to come visit this place with the explicit intention of commemorating it as a quote unquote holy place, right? Whether they're remembering it as the house of the blessed Peter, right? Or if it's a place where Jesus did some really interesting things as we know about from the Gospels. Again, from my perspective, a lot of it has to do with how you view history, right? And if you tend more towards continuity, right? So you see the changes that are happening in the late first, early second century as a first phase, and then you see these renovations in the late fourth century as sort of a second phase, and then in the fifth and sixth century, the big octagonal church is on top. So there's something about this trajectory of, quote unquote, Christian practice and Christian memory on this site. And so, So then the question is, how far back can we go? And again, you know, from my perspective, I think there's good reason to suggest that even though we have no idea what the practices were, there's no signs for, you know, ritual, you know, specific kinds of rituals or anything like that, but that something was happening here that had to do with deeming this room important in some kind of way.
Oh, yeah, interesting. So is there a theory that one of the Gospels was written in Capernaum?
Yeah, there is a theory about that. So this is Christopher Zeichmann's work.
Oh, yes, we've had him on the podcast.
Okay, very interesting. I really like Chris a lot. He's a good friend. He's been very helpful even in my own work. So he's been one of the figures who's written on Capernaum quite a bit from different perspectives. His article suggested that Capernaum was actually written. The Gospel of Mark was actually written in Capernaum, right?
Helen, that's right up your alley.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to hear from a Markan scholar what you think about this, Helen. But I think from what I understand, Chris's work is really interesting, but it hasn't necessarily been fundamental to my take on what was happening in Capernaum around in this time. But I think Chris's take was that, because Mark has a particular interest in Capernaum, more so than the other gospels, certainly. And then there's some other things on sort of from a redactional perspective that he was able to sort of suggest that it was actually written there. Mm-hmm. So I could go either way. I think it's an interesting theory. I think it'd be really, really great if we could prove that. We think in terms of probability, right? And mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's quite probable, but. Mm. What do you think, Helen? Give me your opinion.
I tend to think it was done in a city, but there are a lot of people who think Galilee or Syria, that kind of area. Yep. So I will get Chris's work and have a look at it and stick it into my reading list.
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. Chris has done a lot of really good work, especially on the Roman military, right? And sort of its connection to New Testament tradition. So I've really appreciated his work, on that.
Nice. Well, you mentioned this church, this octagonal church that you say was built, you know, maybe 5th century, something like that, maybe roughly around the same time as that synagogue was built.
Yeah,
I remember when I visited Capernaum, and this is I remember was there's a kind of glass floored thing that they have that's over, you know, Peter's house.
Yeah.
So that's a different structure, but I kind of want to talk about those two things. Maybe a little bit about, you know, what is the significance of this church, but also how it relates to this Peter's house. And do archaeologists think this could actually be, you know, something like that, like a site dating back that far?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, maybe I should state at the outset that, you know, I really haven't done a, I haven't put a lot of skin in the game when it comes to, you know, the question of authenticity and whether this is actually, you know, Peter's house. So I'm much more interested in the development of some sort of memory, right, that takes place in material form around this particular site. So and that seems to be a slam dunk. Like, in other words, what I mean by that is that there's no doubt that this place became a special place of commemoration, right, in later centuries. That doesn't seem to be too debated. Of course, the question that maybe some might be interested in is, well, how, you know, what's the relationship between the tradition that developed and then the actual historicity of it, and whether it was actually Peter's house. I mean, you know, there are some really important scholars who've worked on Capernaum. So the late great James Strange wrote an article with Herschel Shanks on this idea that, you know, archaeologists had found the house of Peter, and so they were pretty convinced. Again, it's some of the same things dealing with how we view making historical judgments, right? I mean, there's nothing that, again, slam dunk. There's nothing that, you know, explicitly says this was Peter's home. There's no Pete was here, you know, type of
Shay Pete.
You know, still looking for that.
Door sign. Yeah, right? Still looking for that. But, you know, again, you know, if you take a diachronic approach, if you can, you know, locate some of that early memory all the way back to the first century, or, you know, late first century, at least early second, you know, then you start to think, well, it's possible. It's certainly possible. So some Christians thought this was Peter's house, right? But, you know, I don't know how we'll ever be able to really say anything, in terms of like its probability. You know, maybe you could say it's plausible, you know, depending how you define those analytical terms, but then, you know, the interesting thing is that as you move then in time, you get to the fourth century, late fourth century, where there's some more renovations taking place in the side of the site. Sometimes scholars will talk about it as the Domus Ecclesiae, or the house church. That's in the late fourth century there, and then in the fifth century, you've got this octagonal church, which really is a fundamental break, right, with how the site was treated in earlier centuries. So the octagonal church really symbolizes architecturally something very different than what the house was in its earlier phases. So, you know, we could talk about what, you know, my own interpretation of that if you want to, but it does, I think the fifth and sixth century really does become a fundamental, like kind of a turning point in what's happening in Capernaum, at least in terms of the development of Christianity, because at the same time, you have the construction of the white limestone synagogue across the street, right? So, and that's what I'm interested in, is sort of the dialectical relationship between the two monumental buildings that emerge.
Yeah, and I suppose once you get the monumental buildings, then you clearly have a sense of these are the Jews going there, and they're now properly Christians, I suppose. But I mean, why then? I mean, is that why you think Capernaum is a particularly good location for studying the relationship between Jews and Christians in this early part of the movement?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I tell people when I either lecture or teach on Capernaum is, you know, if we had the image, right, there's this wonderful image from the archaeological reports. You know, if we had it, we'd be able
That's
to show
the trouble
our
with the podcast, no pictures.
I know. But if you can imagine an aerial view, right, of the site, and you have on to the north, you have this massive limestone synagogue, and then to the south, you've got this concentric octagonal church. Like, what it does is it confronts us, right, with our assumptions about what could or could not be possible in terms of Jewish-Christian relations in this particular place, right? The two buildings are separated by at the most 30 meters, maybe more like 25 meters or something like that.
Wow.
So it really is a wonderful entry point into thinking about Jewish-Christian relations. So what in terms of exposing our assumptions, you know, we're asked then to develop our own categories to characterize social interactions. So in other words, what do we say? Do we say, okay, church and synagogue, there must have been conflict between the two. Okay? Church and synagogue, there must have been violence or hostility, you know, between the two. Church and synagogue, maybe they were simply friends and coexistence is the better category, right? So what is it? And then do we have any indication for what that might be? Helen, you mentioned, you know, once you have these buildings, perhaps it becomes clearer, you know, who's sort of in what camp, right? Jews over here with the synagogue, Christians over here with the church. And I think that might be true from an ideological perspective, right? If we were to interpret architecture in a way that assumes that architecture sends meaning, right? We have, it expresses a certain kind of mode of identity, right? Then, yeah, I do think that we have monumental architecture that establishes or is meant to establish some sort of distinction, right? Between this is us as Christians, this is us as Jews. But this is also where it's interesting then to read some of the literary sources that we have around the same time against the grain, where at least on the grassroots level. So forget about the rhetorical level of the monumental architecture, but if we go down to the street view and we read some of these sources critically, then, you know, we actually have some material that might suggest that Christians were hanging out in synagogues, right? You know, some specific materials suggest that Christians went to synagogues for prayer, or they were attracted to synagogues because they felt like synagogues had some sort of noumenal power, right? Amuletic power to cure illnesses or ward off evil or those kinds of things too. So there's a sort of a quote unquote magical element to it as well. So there are all these other kinds of ways that we could conceive of Jewish Christian relations when we separate our analytical views, right? We've got the ideological rhetorical level and then the street level view. And so I'm interested in that interplay, right? And how the two might relate to each other.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I know that a lot of your work has been sort of outside of those monumental structures, because like you said, it would be so easy just to be like, wow, we have these two things facing off with each other. What does that mean? Yeah. But you've broadened your scope and you're interested in what were these relations like in the domestic life and in these kind of neighborhoods around it. So yeah, tell us maybe a good place to start is kind of like what architecturally, you know, what would these homes, what would these neighborhoods have looked like back in these early centuries?
Yeah, well, I mean, so yeah, this is great. So I'll have to kind of limit myself to what I say here. But what I've tried to do is, you know, if you start with the monumental buildings that tower over this sort of built landscape, okay, you can interpret them. But then, as you mentioned, Dave, you go down to the street level view, you get into the sort of the domestic context. Sometimes we forget that these monumental buildings are actually couched within the context of houses and streets and workshops, right? And these kinds of everyday life types of built environment. And so I think, you know, what I've tried to do is actually consider what the domestic architecture, or what kind of insight looking at the domestic architecture of the village could then allow us to then come back to interpreting the monumental architecture of the church and synagogue. And so, you know, all it takes is sort of one look at, I mean, whether you're there at the site or if you look at a village plan, right, and you see kind of the messiness of everything except the church and the synagogue, right? The church and the synagogue are easy to point out, no problem, okay? But then try to tell me where one house starts and the other ends, or, you know, vice versa. It's the domestic landscape is so fundamentally relational, right? I mean, it's. I mean, you can't get away from the fact that people in Capernaum, Jews or Christians, lived cheek by jowl, right? I mean, they really were living in close contact with one another. In some contexts, so at least according to one study, some of the houses might have even shared entryways, right? And so imagine what kind of social relationships could have been there. And there's no indication that, you know, Jews were on one side of the village and Christians were on another side. There's just nothing that suggests that. So if we can at least agree that Jews and Christians were living in this space, perhaps also in the 5th and 6th century, perhaps also Jewish quote-unquote Christians or Jesus-oriented Jews, then we really do have a diverse setting where you have, on the domestic level, Jews and Christians rubbing elbows, you know, rubbing shoulders with each other every day, perhaps for just mundane reasons too. You know, we got to make life work in this kind of environment. You know, we don't want to kill each other because that just won't let allow us to accomplish our daily task. We have to, quote-unquote, make do, right? Then, you know, we have a really vibrant way then of coming back to the monumental architecture and suggesting, well, maybe the divisions between the two weren't as stark on the social level as we might think. So that's how I would approach it, at least.
Hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. And what about commercial spaces, workshops, that kind of thing, markets? I mean, is there any suggestion that there were sort of Jewish markets, Christian markets, or maybe you just can't tell that.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly can't. There's no division in terms of like ethno-religion, right? I mean, there's no Jews over here, Christians over here, none of that for sure. But I mean, the site itself seems to be divided by, I mean, it's, for lack of a better term, it's a Cardo Maximus, right? I mean, it's a major street that runs just to the east of the synagogue and the church. It kind of cuts through the entire village. And there's a couple of side streets as well that intersect. And there does seem to have been at least a few shops that lined that major road. And so this would be getting into Cynthia Baker's work a little bit, where I mean, she doesn't talk about Capernaum specifically necessarily, but the idea that even these types of small villages would have had some sort of shuk or some sort of marketplace, right? And usually it's on the major street, right? So the major street allows for that sort of public interaction that's revolving around commerce, revolving around other kinds of social interactions, would have also probably involved interactions between Jews and non-Jews as well. So if we see, you know, there's the Capernaum being in the context of travel, especially pilgrimage by the time the 5th and 6th century roll around. So yeah, and then there's also some good evidence in one part of the village where you have a fairly large house that had an industrial complex attached to it for making olive oil, right? So there's a big olive press with a number of different kinds of tools that are there. So the division between workspace and home space, right, is very very porous, right? And so it's the same thing, like especially when you talk about houses in the context of the peristyle courtyard, right? Courtyards are not really private space, right? In that sense, homes aren't really private space the way that we think of it, that we might think of it today. So these contexts are always, much more social and relational than we think, which you know, it's really interesting when you think about Jewish-Christian relations in that type of setting.
Yeah,
I love it. I mean, it paints such a clear picture to me, especially when you started off and said that this might have been a town of 1,500 people. I mean, that is so small, but also so densely packed still. I mean, then I'm just picturing, you know, all these people sort of crawling over each other, but living in these homes that are sort of shared and these marketplaces. Like, you can't, they were not avoiding each other. And I like how you made it clear that, right, there's no archaeological evidence that says that they were, you know, Jews and Christians or Jewish Christians, you know, would have been in separate parts of this town. There's nothing that points to that, right?
No, not at all. I mean, one of the things that we can say is, especially in the 5th century, so, you know, we're getting, well post-Constantine and kind of into the era of the great, well, I should quote unquote, the well-known, how about that, Byzantine emperors, where you do have the emergence in a very strong kind of way of Christian material culture, right? So you do have, of course, the church itself, but then we've got an influx of pottery, right? Fine wares that are stamped with crosses and those kinds of things. But those are spread around everywhere in the village, right? There's no sort of like Christian quarter versus like a Jewish quarter. They're just everywhere. And this is because Capernaum, just like the rest of ancient Palestine or late ancient Palestine, is under Byzantine rule, right? And so there's no doubt that the Jewish community would have been a minoritized group and they would have been a colonized group, absolutely. But this doesn't mean that they were somehow restricted to their own spaces in this particular village. So we need to think about the larger political context and then how that's seen or how that's shown or shows itself in the material record, but not at the same time saying that this is then evidence for somehow some sort of stark division between the powerful and the oppressed, right? There's a little bit more complicated than that, certainly materially. And probably I would also say on a social historical level too.
I think you found some really intriguing polemical texts, didn't you? That from, is it the 6th century or so, that talk about Christians going into synagogues and Jews going into churches. And so, I mean, that just backs up what you're saying, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is kind of what I was talking about before. You have some of what it's coming from is actually canon law, right, or church law, ecclesiastical law, that starts to emerge in the 4th century, but then, develops and becomes kind of collected in a sort of a some sort of code that we know of today as the canons of the apostles. And some of these canons, some of these laws are explicit about trying to restrict both clerics and lay people from going into synagogue spaces, right? So, which if we read it critically, if we read it against the grain, obviously means that there were people, right? There were church clerics and there were lay people going into synagogues to pray or to light lamps or do these kinds of things. And I think it's really interesting this sort of literature is not singular either. Like we could put it in a larger historical context where, you know, if we go all the way back to the 3rd century with Origen, right? Origen has a really interesting text where he's talking to his congregants and he knows that some of them were in the synagogue the day before, mm-hmm. right? So they've done some learning on Saturday in synagogue and then now they're on Sunday in his church. Of course, John Chrysostom is very well known for his polemicizing against Jewish people and the synagogue specifically. So there does seem to be a especially in the eastern parts of the empire, a pretty long-held social convention of Christians, non-Jewish Christians, who are attracted to synagogue spaces for various kinds of reasons. So, and I think Capernaum is, you know, potentially, if we read Capernaum in that sort of environment, then why not, right? Why can't we see Christians attracted to this, you know, big, grandiose, you know, wonderful limestone synagogue in the 5th and 6th centuries.
And do you get it the other way too? I mean, do we have evidence of non-Christian Jews going along to a Christian service of some kind?
Yeah, so not as much, that's for sure. And so what I've suggested is, so I've read a particular passage from a late Midrash, it's Kohelet Rabbah, which is, you know, 6th to 8th century redacted, but it's from late ancient Palestine. And there does seem to be a story in this Midrash that, in my interpretation, there's a sort of a rabbinic prescription of that intends to keep Jews away from churches, right? And so the house of the authorities, it's called. So don't get too close, right? It's sort of couched within an interpretation of Proverbs 5 and the adulterous woman. And so stay away, keep your social distance, right? That kind of idea is communicated there, but it's specifically with regard to this house of the authorities with the church. So, but other than that, I'm not aware. I mean, there might be out there. I'm not a Talmudic scholar, so I don't have necessarily the breadth of expertise on that. But there does seem to be at least an indication that rabbinic Jews, from the perspective that I'm reading them, heresiologists in their own right, trying to kind of keep average Jews away from Christian spaces, but on the ground, that's not happening, right? Some Jews at least are attracted to synagogue to church spaces as well. So it seems to go both ways, even if the literature the literary sources are much heavier on the Christian side. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. I think this time period is so interesting for so many reasons. I think one of the big questions, you know, in biblical studies and in the history of this time period is, when did Jewish Christians stop being Jewish and just become Christians? You know, when did we have these categories that were clear cut, you know, in our heads of a difference between the Jews and the Christians, since Christianity obviously starts as a Jewish movement? So what do you feel like the evidence in Capernaum can tell us about this, you know, kind of parting of the ways, as it's called? Like, is it a little messier than we would tend to think it was, or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly would say I would echo what you just said, right? That it's certainly messier than the kind of older traditional paradigms where, you know, whatever we put it, 70 CE or some person, I think someone put it at 96 CE, right? The ways parted. I mean, I think, you know, in general, scholarship has gotten away from that and has appreciated the sort of long, drawn-out process that was involved in the sort of formation of separate Jewish and Christian identities. But one of the things that I've tried to point out as it relates to Capernaum is, I guess, something that I've already said, is that we need to sort of read the sources on two different levels, right? We have a source like Ignatius, right? Ignatius of Antioch, 2nd century, according to sort of traditional dating or whatever, who's making these strong distinctions between Judaismos and Christianismos, right? Judaism over here, Christianity over here. But, I mean, so what does that mean? Does that mean that the ways had parted? Or is this just, you know, an example of a Christian literary elite person trying to make that distinction for the sake of forming some sort of notion of Christian identity? It probably means on the ground those two social groups were in no way bifurcated that way. So I think that that's true, you know, as we move, you know, through the evidence from Capernaum, but just in general, that we need to read, have these sort of this distinction between our analytical levels, right? On the one level, yeah, there's a lots of separation, right? The church and the synagogue, two very, you know, distinct projections of Jewish and Christian identity, but on the ground, it seems to be much more ambiguous, right? With Christians attracted to Judaism, Jews attracted to Christianity. Certainly in some quarters we've got lots of evidence too where there was hostility. So I don't want to minimize that, right? On other parts of the empire, or there are sources that talk about, you know, for instance, Christians who burned synagogues, right? So, it's not that we don't have that. It's just that, when we, you know, take our evidence on a case-by-case basis, we have lots that might suggest that at least in some corners of the Roman and Byzantine world, these divisions were simply non-existent, right? They just didn't people on the ground just didn't work with the kinds of categories and divisions that we work with today. So issues of categorization and typologies, that's our problem, right? That wasn't their problem. They didn't work with those, with that frame of reference.
Mm, that's fascinating. Maybe they just didn't think they had to make a choice. You know, they thought it was perfectly fine to be both.
Yeah.
And so I mean, we've moved away from kind of the archaeology, I suppose, of Capernaum now. But but what does this tell us about you know, the limits of archaeology to be able to faithfully reconstruct the lived past?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, on a very basic level, archaeology has limits. I mean, it is absolutely true. And I think this is the great, you know, the significance of Joan Taylor's critique, right? So Joan, you know, was really, really important in terms of kind of pumping the brakes on what archaeology can really tell us about Jewish-Christian relations, or about even quote-unquote Jewish Christianity, or those kinds of things, and then how we see that and read those categories into the archaeological record of some of these holy sites, these quote-unquote holy sites. So I think, you know, in some ways the pendulum has swung, right? And so maybe if we talked about like sort of the early and mid-20th century, people were really optimistic about what archaeology could tell us about Jewish-Christian relations, about the parting of the ways, about Jewish Christianity, these kinds of things. Then Joan's work came in and swung the pendulum the other way. And what I'm hoping to do is kind of bring the pendulum back in the middle somewhere, where we have to, as you say, appreciate that archaeology is not going to just, like any ancient source, is not going to drop, you know, from the sky, ready-made historical knowledge, right? We have to build history in that kind of way. We have to make, I don't mean this fancifully, but we have to make history, right? We build history through interpreting the sources critically and so on and so forth. And so when we take that type of approach to history, then perhaps the pendulum can swing back and we can appreciate what archaeology can tell us, what the textual sources can tell us, and then we can use them together to actually build a picture of the past. So I think so much caution is absolutely necessary, but we also shouldn't be afraid of actually making some historical arguments and continuing the critical process.
Awesome. Yeah, Joan, another good friend of the podcast, obviously close colleague of Helen. I had no idea that she played such a big role in this corner too.
No, I didn't either.
Absolutely.
Another thing for the reading list. I'm getting so many things from this that I need to read up on.
All right, this is the most exciting part of the podcast. This is where all these dreams that you have of finding, you know, the evidence that tells you exactly what happened at this place, you're not even going to need that evidence because you're going to go there and you're going to see it with your own eyes. So when you get a turn in our time machine, which you will have, where and when do you want to go?
Okay, can I clarify the question, though? Because, I mean, this is a big question.
Please.
This is really a big question.
It's a big question. Yeah, there's a lot riding on this.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, do I have to go, like, somewhere that relevant to, like, the, like, biblical stuff? Or can it...
Yes, I should say you can go anywhere. You could go into the future, I should also specify.
Okay.
This is a true time machine.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm living in southern Sweden now, and I've gotten really interested in local southern Sweden history. So I live in this small village, this tiny village, and apparently I just, you know, just found this out from some local tradition, that back in the 1920s, there was an excavation done in my small village of 1,700 people that found some really interesting stuff, some materials that date all the way back to the 5th century and that apparently came from the Roman world. I mean, there are these sort of equestrian tools and materials, so like evidence of like horse riders and horse, you know, people who deal with horses in southern Sweden. And then, so I've gotten really interested in sort of the connections between southern Sweden and the Roman Empire in the 5th and then 6th centuries. So I have no idea if that's going to, if that would have to do with anything, you know, in terms of religious studies, but I'm really interested in now my local history, where I'm living. And then, yeah, just sort of the development of the Viking Age as well is kind of really fascinating and stuff. So I'd probably go, you know, somewhere in between the 5th to the 8th century southern Sweden.
Southern Sweden.
Sounds nice.
Very cool. It sounds... It sounds lovely. Can you imagine Helen living in a village in southern Sweden? I mean, Wally, he really scored.
I'd go in the summer, though, maybe.
It's not a bad...
I wouldn't want a Swedish winter.
That's true.
But yeah, no, it sounds, it sounds very good.
All right. Well, Wally, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a very interesting discussion. I hope our listeners enjoyed it as much as we did. Thank you, Helen. And we will see all of you on the next episode of Biblical Time Machine. Bye.
Bye.
All right, everybody, I teased at the top of the show that Helen and I are going to participate in the SBL virtual global meeting. It's true. We're going to do a live taping of the podcast. So if you want to see us do the podcast live during the meeting, all you got to do is join the Time Travelers Club and enter yourself into the running for a free pass to that 4-day virtual conference coming up April 1st through April 4th. Thanks for listening. Thanks for all your support, and we'll see you next time.